Andrew Bridgen, happy new year to you. I hope 2024 is the year when the liars are exposed and the truth tellers triumph. What's your wish for this new year, Andrew?
Well, I've told all my friends and colleagues I want this 2024 to be the year of truth, justice and freedom. And I think if we all work together and we coordinate, I think we can deliver that. It feels as if things are happening and information's coming out rather faster than it was before. I think that's the speed of disclosure of information is increasing. And I don't know if you noticed, but we've had a sort of, after 14 years of investigating and working on behalf of my constituents on the post office scandal, there's been a massive disclosure on that. And it's really rocked our parliament and public opinion. And I think this shows us, Liz, how the silence and complicity of the media over issues, it works. And the moment they don't, suddenly an issue has been buried for 14 years. That's the wrongful imprisonment and fining and criminalisation of some postmasters due to a faulty IT system over here. It's just blown the whole thing up in days following a docudrama by ITN.
What do you think made them change?
The sad thing is that I had all the evidence probably 10 years ago, and I went around all the TV studios and told all those journalists, run this story, here's all the evidence, this is the biggest miscarriage of justice in UK history, and you'll get an award for running this story. And I went around every news outlet, mainstream newspaper, all the journalists liked it 10 years ago, but none of the editors had ever run the story. And now they're claiming the hypocrisy of the media now is breathtaking.
What are they claiming now? What are they saying that they didn't have?
Oh, they've done this fantastic docudrama and it's blown the whole thing up. But I mean, they could have done it 10 years ago. And the amount of human misery that's been inflicted on innocent people is terrible.
That's a real, I don't know, it's a synchronicity. It feels like a note to you from the universe on the right track, Andrew, but that is heartbreaking. I believe 2024 is the year the world has to start pointing the finger at the media of the world, owned as they are by BlackRock and Vanguard, and saying, you are betraying the people. I think that might be a part we all have to do, to demand of these individuals working for mainstream media outlets, you are traitors to the people.
I think the people already know that. I mean, the number of people paying attention in the UK to the mainstream media is decreasing, but clearly that hits their revenues and then makes them more reliant on the drip feed of money from big pharma and governments, because that's all they've got. Because quite honestly, people are handing in their television licenses over here, left, right and centre.
But over here in New Zealand, since Barry Young put out the mother of all revelations, which truly is, because it's the Ministry of Health data and they are scared. I mean, they're threatening $40,000 fines if he talks about it. You don't do that if there's nothing to the story. So it's not a nothing burger, that's for sure. But here, the response in mainstream media, Andrew, is, oh, there's a new wave of COVID and it's so serious and you must mask up, New Zealand. It's happening across the Tasman. They're trying to run the rort again. They're trying to run the con.
Yeah, I think, catch me once, shame on you. Catch me twice, shame on me. I think too many people have wised up on this. And, of course, pushing this narrative, it merely undermines the credibility of the mainstream media once again. So they really are stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, of course, the record-level data that Barry bravely disclosed, we've got exactly the same data held by our government. Indeed, these are issues I'm going to be raising at the debate we've managed to get on excess deaths next Tuesday.
Let's talk about that. But before we do, talk about the shocking invitation you had to coincide with your brave debate that you managed to bring forward. What happened from the World Economic Forum?
Well, I got an invite. I was contacted initially on the phone by someone who I've spoken at events for this firm before in the City of London, mainly around the Brexit issue, which obviously wasn't that popular in the city, but I presented many times representing the case for the UK leaving the European Union. And they were pretty good events. You know, it's nice to have a sort of not necessarily partisan audience, and you've got to sell your message. So I've been many times into the city and spoken at breakfast and lunchtime meetings over the years. But this was a sort of special invite, and it was to a named hotel in Davos, and the event was being run by financial managers to speak at a dinner on Davos on the 16th of January, which happens to be exactly the same day I'm supposed to be leading a debate, which we've been long awaited for, on trends in excess deaths, a 90-minute debate, which we'd obtained by petition of members of Parliament, following my expert presentations from Ryan Cole and Pierre Corey and Robert Malone.
David Martin, Steve Kirsch.
David, absolutely. And MPs have then backed my calls and signed a petition, and we got through the backbench business committee a 90-minute debate we were given on the 16th. So it's quite a coincidence, I'd say, that I was invited to be pulled away with a nice dinner in Davos and all the hospitality on exactly the same day. My duties would hold me here in the House of Commons. But of course, I publicised the fact that I'd been offered that incentive not to be in Parliament on that day. And I think we've shown them for what they are. I don't believe in coincidences anymore, Liz. There's just too many of them.
No, coincidence might be the most mild term. I would say bribe, and I would go much further than that. Corruption, it reeks of that. It's really a test of the character now of politicians around the world. Are you going to be seduced by these pathetic invitations from the World Economic Forum, or are you going to stay and serve your constituents? And Andrew, when you notified me of that invitation, you simply said a wonderful line. You said, I wasn't voted in by my constituents to fly off to Davos, to a group who are not even voted in by the people of the UK or here in New Zealand. I'd say any politician who accepts these World Economic Forum invitations is showing themselves to be prone to betraying their country at the very least, and possible bribery and corruption at the worst.
Yes. So obviously I'm not going to be attending the event. And I think the fact that I've publicised that I had an invite and I'm not going, I'm going to speak I'll lead the debate on excess deaths on the same day. I think that puts quite a bit of pressure on colleagues. I mean, it's very easy for them to have said, well, I had an invite and they went. Mm-hmm. But people would say, well, you shouldn't have gone. Well, you weren't invited. Well, I was invited and I'm not going. So I can criticise people who do attend the World Economic Forum. It's unelected, unaccountable people who have great sway. It's amazing that all over the world, whatever the World Economic Forum announces their new policy, governments suddenly start slavishly adopting it, and it's got to stop.
So many Kiwis watching this will be wishing that we had an Andrew Bridgen in our parliament. I mean, I'm one of those. I just wish you were over here. The UK is so lucky to have you. Tell us about, first of all, let's go back a little bit, the reaction within Parliament to that pre-Christmas experts discussion that you had. That was quite an extraordinary group of thinking people from around the world.
Yes, well, we've been through the names. I mean, they are world experts. I think every single one of them, apart from Steve Kirsch, I've spoken on platforms around Europe, mostly Scandinavia. Obviously, I've been on many Zoom calls with them from around the world as well. So they're a fantastic team. I mean, every one of us has basically had our reputations traduced and been vilified. And in many cases, I've been thrown out of the Conservative Party. They've lost their positions at universities and hospitals as a result of being attacked. We've all been attacked in the media. And I think it's, to stand in the UK Parliament, in a committee room, present to MPs who are receptive to listen, at least to listen, in that sort of company of people who really gone out on a limb and they've stuck to their truth. I mean, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants there. These are great people, and I hope when history is written, they get the credit that they deserve. Because, I mean, the questions from the MPs afterwards I've been speaking out for over a year now. We've made huge progress because I wouldn't have got 16 or 20 MPs in a room being willing to listen to that content a year ago. Many of them stopped for the full 2-hour presentation. And at the end, I got 16 MPs who are willing to sign. And we have been able to go through parliamentary procedure here to force the House of Commons to have a 90-minute debate next Tuesday. But Liz, there are a lot of coincidences about that meeting. It was in Portcullis House, which is the new part of our parliament. It's about 20-odd years old. And we'd originally booked the Boothroyd room, which was the biggest committee room. It can hold 120 seated. Obviously, I knew that it would be popular and I wanted to leave room for colleagues to attend. So we were invited about 70 members, supportive members of the public and friends and families of the speakers, leaving plenty of room for members of the House of Lords and Commons and the press to attend. It's interesting that I don't think not one member of the mainstream lobby journalists turned up for that meeting on the 4th of December, despite 20-odd MPs and some members of the House of Lords being there. But it was the other issues around. So about a week before the event, and I booked the room months in advance, as you have to in our parliament to get that sort of room, we were moved to a room half the size in the same building. We were told that the original room was needed for a committee meeting of the House of Commons to do with the renewals and repairs of the building. Mysteriously, that meeting never went ahead. It was the room was never occupied during the time period that we were in having our debate. And so that was cancelled. So we moved the room. There were two security guards placed outside of the room, which has never happened in the history of an event in Parliament booked by a member of Parliament. Guests were told that they at the last minute that they had to bring proof that they were invited to the meeting, and some people were turned away, which is again outrageous. And we had a massive IT failure. So in this committee room, which is the most modern part of our parliament, there are synchronized television screens all over the room. They weren't synchronized. We had the IT engineers in and told them what we wanted. We had a cable to a laptop so we could put the presentations up, and they worked fine. The screenshots worked fine. But we also had two recordings of interviews, one with Mike Yeardon and one with Peter McCullough, who couldn't be present, but we wanted their input. And what we found out was that the IT engineers had turned the television volume down to zero. There were no manual buttons on the television to turn it back up, and they'd taken the remote control with them. So we couldn't play those interviews with sound. And I've made a formal complaint to the House authorities that wasn't handled properly. Having offered a guest list 2 weeks before the event, which was never taken up by the House authorities, when I was actually in the room preparing for the event, I then found that my office got an email demanding a full list of the attendees 40 minutes before we were supposed to start, which I never received because my staff had gone home because it was an evening meeting.
This is sabotage. This shows us how fragile our democracy is. And every single cog in that wheel who's allowing that sort of corruption is contributing to the downfall of their own freedom and their own society. Each person who's willing to be part of that IT person who was willing to do that sabotage, it's disgraceful. But you pressed ahead and you got...
We pressed ahead. Yeah. And with the speakers we had, it meant actually we had more time for Q&As. And also we wanted to film the interviews. I mean, having that quality of expert in the UK Parliament, and at the last minute we refused permission to film it, and the cameras were taken off our film crews.
I would love for the next one if everybody could have a lapel mic and you could even just get really quality sound. Get an audio specialist in there to get everybody lapel mic'd up, because I watched some of it, but the sound was difficult to hear at times.
That's because it had to be filmed off people's mobile phones. Oh. That's all
It's just disgraceful. Does it make you pause at all and waver in your commitment, or does that make you want to double down on your commitment?
Well, it makes me want to double down, because if they had nothing to hide, they wouldn't need to stoop to those levels. And again, they want to shut down the debate. They don't want to have the debate. Mm. And I would say that those who don't agree with what I've been saying for quite a while now, I think, is the cause of the excess deaths around the world, come to our debate on the parliamentary debate next Tuesday and make your points and challenge me. Don't run away.
That's what Steve Kirsch has been begging for, offering to pay for. Just debate me and I will talk to you about the numbers I have. Was Barry Young's data a part of that earlier December meeting? Did the discussion about that New Zealand data come up there?
Yes, Steve Kirsch used it quite extensively. He was able to have an extended address because obviously we lost the two remote interviews presentations because of the IT problems. And we had plenty of time for Q&As as well. And the questions were good, sensible. And it's clear that MPs are coming on board. It's taken a year to get to 16. We'll see. The problem, Liz, is that obviously all those MPs who signed a petition to get the debate with me, they've actually named themselves. I fear they'll be coming under a lot of pressure from the establishment and their own whips not to speak at the debate next week. We'll see. We'll see. That speaks to the fact that they're intimidating people not to attend and speak. There is one of my colleagues who has told me confidentially that they're going to recount personal family incidents of severe vaccine harms, which I think will be pretty devastating if it comes out.
The urge in those who have upheld this lie to keep the lie going, to suppress and censor the truth, is extraordinary in this country as well. The intimidation of Barry Young, or the attempted intimidation, he won't be, but the intimidation of Barry Young, of me, I was served papers before Christmas trying to put an injunction on me not to talk about it. Even Steve Kirsch, they tried an injunction. He laughed and said, I'm not in your jurisdiction. This is the Ministry of Health, which should be the most enthusiastic about getting the truth about what's gone on with this jab, and they are doing their best to suppress everywhere they can. What is going to happen next Tuesday? Tell us the outline of what you're going to have in the UK Parliament.
Well, we've got a 90-minute debate. It's not in the main chamber, it's in the subsidiary chamber in Westminster Hall, but it starts at 9:30. That's before the main chamber sits. So we should be able to go. We should be going out live on the Parliament channel because there's nothing really to compete with that. I get to lead off the debate as I was the sponsor of it. We've got 90 minutes, which is three times longer than I spoke on excess deaths. The only speech we've had is my adjournment debate on the 20th of October last year. So we've got three times more. I'm trying to accommodate all colleagues who wish to be heard. So I'm trying to canvass around and find out how long they want to speak for in each one of their addresses so that we can accommodate all of those. And I'll tailor my speech to whatever I need to be. If I have to be 15 minutes, I'll speak for 15 minutes. If I can do 20, I'll do 20. But I'll try to obviously make sure we use all the 90 minutes up, and there will be a response, I presume, or certainly from the government, from the main opposition party, and I think from the Scottish Nationalists. Well, we need to establish that, but they'll probably have 6 or 7 minutes each or 10 minutes each to respond. So we've probably got an hour between us for raising our concerns. But as long as we use the whole time up, I will be back to the backbench business committee, hopefully with even more signatures, more interest from colleagues. And I will be immediately demanding a 3-hour debate because at the end of the day, the figures don't lie. Well, they're misleading, but they're understated of the excess deaths, and it's not slowing down. So this isn't an issue that we're talking about historically. It's contemporaneous. It's going on every week. We've got this issue, which is affecting every community and every constituency across the land and much of the developed world where the vaccines were rolled out. We've got excess deaths.
It's hideous. So many people at Christmas who were mourning loved ones. And I have a dear friend whose husband's brother was just lying dead in his bed just before Christmas. And they're devastated. It's absolutely ruined their lives. And I thought that's happening across the world, Andrew. This is why we do it. This is why we keep on keeping on. But what do you say as far as the mainstream media presence? What's your challenge to them to be at your debate? And can they be at your debate?
Of course, they can report on it. And again, we'll have a press pack of supportive data for whatever arguments I make. I've got the first draft of my speech for next Tuesday now, and I'll work on it the rest of this week and over the weekend. I mean, obviously, I've got to make sure that whatever facts I'm putting out there, if I put 100 facts out and one's not correct, they'll jump on the one, and that's what we'll hear about. So I really do have to have, and I want to thank Professor Norman Fenton and Dr. Claire Craig at Heart, an organization over here of scientists who are working to get to the truth, for all their support on the technical front and the evidence packs that we'll produce of scientific papers that support the concerns that I will raise in that debate and I've raised in previous debates in the House of Commons, because without that support, it's absolutely invaluable to our cause.
I think Claire and Norman will go down in history's books as well for their bravery, as you will. And I'd say Steve Kirsch too. I've really loved his tenacity. Isn't he been brilliant? Just he will not give up on this. He's like a dog with a bone.
Yeah, he's a very interesting character. I spent some time with all the speakers and their partners over that weekend. And we've got a few characters on our side, and thank goodness for that. And as I say again, they less suffering the slings and arrows which are thrown at them by the mainstream media. There's going to be a reckoning for all of this. And I think when this is over, we can address many things that have gone wrong in our society, which have contributed to the lamentable position we find ourselves in today. And this illusion of democracy, where there is actually no choice at all.
It's corporatization and rule by lies and manipulation propaganda. What are some of those lamentable things that you're talking about? What are some of the things, the aspects you really want to address?
I think quite honestly, we have far too many elected representatives in our parliament. We don't need 650 MPs. It's too many to watch, quite honestly. The party system has let people down. Parties are open to influence and corruption. And the whipping system is unhealthy for democracy. If someone brings forward good legislation, you shouldn't have to whip people to or not vote for it. The vote should be on the basis of the legislation, not party affiliation. And it's always interesting. And I've stood obviously for election in the UK successfully four times at general elections. But you're adopted as a candidate by a party, a sponsoring party, and you're on the list for that at general election, and the manifesto doesn't come out until 2 or 3 weeks into the campaign. In what way, as when you've already been selected as a candidate, can you possibly then you can't say, well, I don't like that policy. So effectively, you're giving support to policies you had and elected on a ticket that you had no idea what they were before you became the candidate. That's no element of democracy or representation of the people. And obviously, I'm standing as an independent at the next general election, which is probably going to be later this year. And my point to my constituents is that I don't doubt that anybody on the ballot paper can represent the party they're representing in my constituency. But the job is for someone to represent the people of North West Leicestershire in Parliament, and that's a different game. That's what we need to get to.
Yep. When we stood in this election and there were interesting results, which, we decided not to question, but many people have said to me, I don't think the results reflect what really happened. Because if they're corrupt and rolling out this jab, could they possibly be corrupt in the way they run elections? Yeah, it's possible.
We've seen it in America, haven't we?
In America. So we're going to really get the momentum for the next election so huge they can't corrupt it. But the biggest thing for us was stand as representatives, which means listening to the people. And the other thing I think, Andrew, you're right about it being too large as a centralised body. decentralize, get it back to the local communities where Andrew Bridgen is walking down his main street in his town and someone comes up and goes, hey, Andrew, I want you to get onto this. And you're answerable to the people. You hear them. You listen to them. The decentralization feels like a key to stopping this terrible corporate corruption of politics. What do you think?
And I think also they're trying to distance the politicians from the people. They will make, you know, they'll say, well, it's security. You can't just wander around as you used to. I mean, I do. I mean, I represent an area I was brought up in. I'm representing the people I went to school with and, you know, the headmaster of my comprehensive school was one of my constituents for many years, you know. That's how we need to get back to that. We can't have elected representatives kept in London and isolated from the people they represent. You need to be really grounded in your communities to know what their sentiment is on various issues. Or we end up in elections, a bit like the European elections, or when we used to be a member of the European Union, which are on the list, the haunt system of a party list. And again, all that reinforces then is that there's no point campaigning because you're not voting for people, you're voting for parties. So there's very little campaigning done by individuals. And clearly, your chances of success as a politician are completely on your loyalty to the party because they're going to decide where you are at the list. And if you're top of the list, you're pretty much guaranteed to get in whatever the vote. And if you're at the bottom of the list, you have no prospect of getting in. And can you imagine if we went onto a system like that? You know, people like me who've spoken against the party line enough actually to get thrown out of the party, but over the years, I mean, you know, I would never have been returned at subsequent elections because I'd have been at the bottom of the list, wouldn't I? Every time you say to the government, actually, you know, this is not really in the interests of my people, whether that's, you know, the post office scandal, which is going to end up costing the government over £2 billion over here in compensation and has dragged on far too long, or HS2, the high speed rail system, which I've voted against and campaigned against for 10 years. Every time it appeared in the House, and that's 90% being scrapped because guess what? It went over budget, it's a disaster, and we've probably lost £30 billion of our government, our taxpayers' money are wasted on this project, and 10 years of debate in the House of Commons for nothing. If only one representative had stood up in that House of Commons and said, this is how it's going to end, well, I did. And clearly that would have... wasn't endearing me with the powers that be in the Conservative Party and the government.
We thought actually we could divide New Zealand into a certain number of cantons, like in Switzerland, and have just one representative per canton and none of this party system. I mean, what you described there about party lists, we have in New Zealand. We were herded into MMP, mixed member proportional representation. It's a nightmare. And if you speak out as a party member, you are dropped down the list. So there's simply sheep following puppets who are being puppet mastered from the World Economic Forum and the WHO and the UN. Where do you stand on this growing debate around the world in countries saying we want to leave the UN, the WHO, and the WEF? We don't want the WHO, for example, having a plandemic treaty and taking away our sovereignty in a supposed next pandemic declared by Bill Gates. Where do you stand on all of that debate, Andrew?
Well, I've also been leading the charge and speaking in the debates about the WHO, the so-called pandemic accord, which became the pandemic agreement, which I've never agreed to and my constituents would never agree to. And of course, the amendments to the international health regulations, which are equally damaging to freedom and democracy. Well, if those two instruments go through, and I hear that New Zealand's put a suspension on their decision whether to accept those instruments and sign up to them. But I mean, that would completely fundamentally change the relationship between the citizen and the state in any country that signed up to those two instruments of the WHO, which is unelected. The WHO are unelected, unaccountable, tax exempt, diplomatically immune from prosecution. And to leave those running, you know, over the top of our democracies, our so-called democracies, and what could possibly go wrong there, Liz?
Oh, and let's not forget that Bill Gates is the Gates Foundation is the biggest funder Bill Gates, who couldn't even keep viruses out of his computers and has no health background, is trying to run the world's health.
What would having someone, who's in Bill Gates's pocket running the world, what could possibly go wrong?
Bring on the Epstein list, I say, Andrew.
It's interesting. It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think that is their Achilles heel. At the end of the day, you know, Bill Gates is someone who's got enough money to do what he wants, where he wants, when he wants. I mean, the question that he needs to be asked is, what was the attraction of Epstein Island so many times?
Mm, exactly. But it's getting back to where we began, Andrew, it's still looking very wobbly for them. They may be trying all their tricks and intimidation and bribery and the things we've covered in this interview. I think they are knowing that their foundations are very much being eaten into by truth tellers around the world who are increasingly brave. What would you say?
I totally agree. But I mean, the more pressure we're putting on them, we are putting considerable pressure on them, the more worried they're going to get and the more dangerous. We are in for a bumpy ride. You know, we could still potentially, they could bring the financial system down and try and implement central bank digital currencies as an alternative. And I still feel that we are being shepherded towards some sort of major Third World War type conflict. And cool heads need to reign supreme in this.
Let's end there with your advice to people who are worried about the CBDC or, you know, an internet failure or, you know, alien invasion, any of these things, and let alone the whole climate change rot, which is really COVID by another name. I agree with you, keeping a cool head, being free of fear. And I'm putting a call out around the world for any whistleblowers, anyone with something they want to tell, tell it now. If we have a million whistleblowers, a million Barry Youngs, there will be a massive wobble in the World Economic Forum, UN, rot that they're doing. But what's your advice to people feeling worried going into the new year?
Well, fear plays into the hands of the tyrants.
Yes.
We've got to look forward to 2024. The current position is untenable for them. So something is going to give. Either we're going into a very dark place or we're going to come out of it. So something, I would say that it's an amazing time to be alive because humanity is on a precipice and we've got decisions to make and we've all got to play our part, but we've got to live our lives without fear because fear plays into the hands of those who wish us harm. So we've got to live, to laugh and to love in the face of adversity. And it's going to be a bumpy ride, but I think we're going to come out of this in a better place.
And my call out is to MSN around the world. I used to be in mainstream media. Please, in the UK, back Andrew Bridgen. He's a damn hero of your country. I wish we had you over here, Andrew. I really do. We'll poach you when one day we'll bring you over here, I think.
I'd love to come over when it's all over, and it will be over, I promise you.
I look forward to meeting you and in person, and we'll catch up through the year, certainly as things evolve with Barry Young. Thank you for all your support and all you are doing. Good luck next Tuesday.
All the best to New Zealand.